try very hard to stay on time, since I know we have a lot of ground to cover. I thought I'd begin with describing my experiment on the plane. Before I left, I talked to a few people who wanted to be here today, and they were very interested on how we were going to share the information that was coming out of this event. And I told them that I was sure it would be blogged furiously as it was going on. But when I was on the plane, I was thinking about, boy, it would be really neat when you use something like S5, which I'm using right here for my slides, if somehow we could tie our audio to every slide. But I've never actually really worked much with audio before, so I'm going to try to record myself as I go through this. And I know I create a file on the other end. I don't actually know if I can actually play it when it's done, but I want to see what happens here. So we're going to do an experiment as we go along here. I'm very new to audio, and I'd love to talk to someone who knows more about it. Okay, so I'm recording. My name's Art Rhino. I'm the systems librarian at the University of Windsor. I've been there for 12 years. I have a computer science degree from 1985. I've been getting myself in technology for over two decades now, or trouble with technology. And I'm taking sort of an odd topic today. I'm going to talk about something called ERP. And I've recently discovered that my children do a lot of public speaking at school and have become quite good at it. So I get some ideas from them about how to punch up my session, because I sort of test things out on them and they didn't think it was that interesting. So I have a subtitle here that they helped me come up with. This is The Secret Lives of Back Office Systems and the People Who Love Them. Okay. Lost focus. Okay, so I always like to start with definitions. They helped me come up with some alternative definitions for ERP. Your challenge is to guess what I'm actually going to talk about. So option A is energetic rodent parties. B is electric reversible pants. C is eccentric roving pachyderms. And D is enterprise resource planning. Unfortunately, this is not that democratic. This is what I'm talking about. ERP, Enterprise Resource Planning Systems, they're systems that I'm sure many of you are somewhat aware of. They're called back office systems with good reason. They run a lot of background kinds of processes, things like logistics, inventory, shipping, invoicing, and accounting, and many more things. They have a lot of connections to supply chain management and things like that. And they're considered some of the largest systems ever written. And if you think about the kind of state information that has to be recorded for things like for processing and supply chains, you can appreciate how complex those kinds of things can be. Here are some examples. I'm sure many of you have at least one of these in your organization. Some universities, like the University of Alberta, I believe, actually use PeopleSoft for their acquisition system instead of using their ILS acquisition system. The University of Windsor at one point held a distinction in Ontario being the only university in Ontario not suing PeopleSoft. So whether that's good or bad, I don't know. I have a friend who does a lot of ERP consulting, and I asked him for some advice about talking about ERP, and this is the quote he gave me. He said, "It is generally despised by programmers with even 1 ounce of creativity." But the good news for you is I don't really have time to talk about ERP itself in general, so you don't have to suffer through that part very much. And Wikipedia has a pretty good starting point on ERP. So you may wonder, well, why should I care anyway? Well, the reason is we're all impacted by these kind of systems. These kind of systems typically run in our organization somewhere within our integrated library system. Our acquisitions module is really sort of an ERP system. Those are the kinds of parts of a system that sell integrated library systems. Those are the kind of systems that tend to have the most work done in terms of things like RFPs. And those are the kind of things that sometimes mean other parts of the system don't work that well, because the sad truth is when we're buying integrated library systems, at least, we put a lot of emphasis on how it handles the processing side of our operations. So ERP kinds of hooks are in everything we do at some level. This here's a screenshot of an acquisitions module from a certain unnamed library system. And this, some of this session I really slanted towards the Pines folks, and I hope we can talk a bit about how these things might come together. But my message here is basically that if you need an acquisitions function, I'm really hoping to try to convince you today that you don't have to build it yourself, that there are things out there that can help you with these kinds of things, because they're very difficult to build, and I'm not sure you'd want to maintain it after you built it anyway. So, what are the contenders for ERP? Well, there's really four of them, and I'm just going to briefly describe these. One's called GNU Enterprise, and it's a fairly recent project. GNU Enterprise is Python-based, and it's really quite an interesting project, and these slides have the links to all these. They're very easy to find. But they built in a layer of abstraction from the ground up, which I think is kind of interesting, and it's quite typical of Python-type development, that they purposely are building things that can plug into other environments really well. So this one's worth tracking. Unfortunately, there's not a lot there yet. So it's not ready to go live with yet, but it's worth tracking. CompuAir is probably the most deployed open source ERP system in the world right now. It's often in the top five downloads at SourceForge. Fairly widely used, very Oracle-centric. They haven't really nailed database independence yet, though they have recently started to support Sybase. There's also one called ERP5 that's used in a production setting at least two places right now. It's SOAP-based. They've done a lot of add-ons to handle things like resource calculations, and you'll see a bit of why those kind of things tend to get added on. But the one I'm going to focus on the most is something called OffBiz, which is a short form of Open for Business. And it's a Java-based system that has support for almost any transaction-aware database. So it's the most database-independent type of ERP system that's out there right now. There are more in various stages of development, but these are probably the four, if you were to go live today, you'd want to look at. And I'm going to just briefly cover some reasons why I like OffBiz in particular. And one of them is the data modeling has been pretty well done in it. The OffBiz project is run by two developers who were previously consultants in ERP systems. They have some business background. They seem to understand business quite well. One of their sources is something called the Data Model Resource Book, and that's a two-volume set. I don't know if anyone's familiar with it, but it's sort of like a Bible in terms of data modeling, and it's very extensive. For example, if you look in the Data Model Resource Book on how to model a person, they have a whole section on how you would model something like gender. They have a section on how you would model gender changes, and they have a section on how you would model multiple gender changes for one person. When you think about the level of detail those kinds of thought decisions require, you can appreciate why it's good if someone's done the groundwork for this kind of thing. And Lynn Silverstone, who's the author of the Data Model Resource Book, is quite well known for this kind of thing. Anyway, they have some very solid building blocks. One other reason I like OffBiz is that it's actually used in production, and one of the places that uses it right now is a company called Discovery Toys. And when my wife and I moved to Windsor in 1993, we actually sold Discovery Toys for a while, and I'm going to try to tie that together at the end. But OffBiz is actually used in production in places. You can't see the screenshot that well. OffBiz is very big. Any ERP system is. It has literally thousands of entities you need to go through for setting up workflows and things like that. It's probably a good example of where you'd want to look at a consulting firm or some sort of value-added service to get someone to help guide you through all these pieces. OffBiz also has Java underneath, and Ed Summers made the comment in Code for Live. He was quoting a statement that Java is the new COBOL. But I think OffBiz is a good example that Java is sort of the new assembler. You actually never actually see Java when you work with OffBiz, but Java runs underneath it to make it all come together. And I think if you think back to my era in the 80s when you did development, that's sort of where assemblers at. You rarely ever touched it. You only did it when you had to do really gnarly kinds of programming. And I can see application frameworks that use Java have sort of become that in our time. So OffBusiness is a very big application. The one that I think is the closest to acquisitions types of functions is the manufacturing module. And one of my kids said that what I should do when I do a slide is to have sort of a dialogue with the audience and write out what kind of things might go back and forth. So he sort of helped me came up with this here dialogue. And it's a little combative, as my children tend to be when they do public presentations, and you actually can't see it all. But I like this statement at the end. What do you mean that still doesn't make sense? Do you think that technology is always intuitive? What about the notion of a foul-mouthed Italian soupy bot blurting into technical discussions every few minutes? How intuitive is that? And if you're on the Code for Live channel, you know what that's all about. So anyway, but manufacturing's actually very close to library operations. When you think of manufacturing in an ERP context, what you're doing is you're taking a bunch of goods together to supply a service. You have schedules for those goods to arrive, and you have workflow considerations for getting those goods out somewhere. It's very close to how we do acquisitions within libraries. This is an example. Sorry, you're probably not going to be able to see this at all, but this is how manufacturing looks within OffBiz right now. So in this case, I'm interested in modeling a book order in terms of a manufacturing application. The screen I want you to see is really this one. One thing that ERP systems spend a lot of time concentrating on is workflow. And most ERP systems have some sort of rules engine or something like that to not only track how long it takes to do something, but to work out the cost justification for that process. When you think of about a library acquisitions module, we don't tend to have those kind of things yet. If you were in a room right now of ERP people, things like rules engines for workflow would be the hot topic. So it's not only that the front end of our systems need a lot of work because they don't do the things they should do, but even the back end, which causes the front end not to work that well, doesn't quite meet the level of how back end systems work either. So I actually wonder if you were to use an ERP system to do acquisitions processing, if there's lots of things you could do in an open source context that you can't do with a commercial system right now. And I think it would be worth looking at. So I'm interested in a system like this, and in honor of Evergreen, I've called it Woodchip. And I thought it was appropriate since I gather beavers are quite big here at Oregon State University. So I think you could model an acquisitions process within an ERP system, and I'm quite interested in talking to the Pines folks about how this might work. I think it's well worth pursuing how those kind of things can come together, because like I say, they are very big systems to build. And I know with our integrated library system, if you go through and do nothing but count the number of Oracle tables that do different processes in our system, you will discover the vast majority of them go to supporting the acquisition side of our system, not the public side. And I think that's part of the reason why our public side of our systems doesn't tend to work so well. So I thought I would end with a lesson from one of the products I sold in 1993, and this is something called Beep Beep Buggy. Beep Beep Buggy was our biggest seller in 1993, and I think the reason it was, it has almost a perfect user interface. It had a nice big steering wheel, it had a great big horn all the toddlers could reach, and you can't see it here, but it had this sort of clutch thing that did really neat things. Sometimes I think the front end of our library systems are more like the other kinds of toys we sold, you know, get to know your spatial objects and professions of the future and things like that. Whereas I think a lot of our users are really looking for things like Beep Beep Buggy. I wonder if we can get some slack on the back end, if we can use other plumbing to do back end processes, can we work more on the front end? And I'm right on the 15-minute mark. That's the formal part of my presentation, so I got 5 minutes for questions, if any. Well, thank you very much.
hit a button to stop the recording or anything?
No, I just go let it run.
Okay, I'll return your power to you, Hydro. Hi, everybody. My name's Dan.
Hi, Dan.
My name's Dan, and I'm a librarian. Today is my 3,472nd day as a librarian. Oh, never mind. We got it? The one thing about OS X is that they never tell you what the magic incantations are. So if anyone can tell me what the magic incantation is to stop the search for a signal, I don't know what it is.
You want to try F7, Dan?
F7. Do I have to do that? Okay.
Displays.
Those of you who know me, which is a surprising number of people, know that I'm not good at the day after I travel.
There you go.
So, there we go. That's better. Oh, and and it's not very bright because I turn the brightness down, maybe. Well, that color is just really no good, is it?
The days of wine.
Art, could you maybe give him your connector? This might be your.
I don't have DVI.
Yeah.
No. There we go. Okay, so all right. Hi, everybody. I'm Dan. 11:06, so we're right on schedule, as they say. Those of you who know me also know that I'm not one to speak shortly. So there's a lot of stuff to talk about, and we've only got like 15 to 20 minutes, so I say very little. But I'm gonna repeat this point. We're gonna have a breakout session on API later in the day. So any questions or whatever, we're going to work on the spec itself, but that's going to be a really good time if there's something I don't cover, some basic questions you have. Write them down and come see us later or, accost me at any time. I have three things to talk about today. Why on API? What is UNAPI? And fun with UNAPI, with the tool called OPA that I've been working on. And if you're wondering, there are three ways to pronounce, in my mind, on API. I like UNAPI because it's kind of derogatory second person. So the first question is why on API? Oh yeah, we got the color thing happening. That's really not cool.
It looks a lot better that way.
See, this is the part where you're supposed to. All right.
Don't move.
Yeah. Can you read the text? I got this fun tool called Comic Life the other day. Hopefully it'll actually add to the presentation. So why on API? Well, first of all, it's easier to mix information these days. There are lots of cool web APIs that we all know about, so I won't talk about them too much. Maps, photos, calendars, search, harvesting, syndicating, and lots of people are doing lots of really cool mashups with these things. In our community, there's not so much of that yet, so we need to jump into this pool head first. Maybe like the scenario of the remote villages who never got landlines for phone, who can like very cheaply put up cell towers. Maybe we're in a strategic advantage to leverage all our data without a lot of capital investment. But who knows? And generally, because of this proliferation of APIs, it's simply easier to move information around. What that means, I think, and the real premise behind this work that I try to keep centered on is that no matter how good your web app is, no matter how many features you add to it, no matter how one-stop shop-ish, to reference a point Lorcan Dempsey made really well at Access last year, nobody's going to spend all their time in your one web app. They're not. It's just not going to happen. That's not how people behave. And remix culture itself is unstoppable. So a formulation that several of us here had in a paper that we wrote for Ariadne last year is that basically our ability, and that our is really everybody, but specifically in libraries too, our ability to meet users' needs is completely limited by our inability to let them create and connect information from various sources as they see fit. That's the main limiting factor here. So the goal is to try to get past that barrier. So for instance, what if web apps work like phones? You know, you can pick up a phone anywhere in the world. It can look like a mouse, or it can look like an old school dial phone, or it can have changeable faceplates. You know, generations of technology, they all work. I used to use a metaphor for this, trying to talk about it in terms of dial tone. You pick up a phone, you get dial tone, you know, you can connect. You can layer things on top of it, like fax machines. But there's a really important point there, because with phones, they've kind of solved this problem. With API mashups, we haven't. The more connections between services you have, the complexity and importance of those things grows over time as well. So as the complexity of all these interconnections grows at big O of n squared, and you have the thousands of people switching phone lines in the one corner, what you have to do is stay over to the left with the happy Mickey face, making sure that everyone can use things at an O1 sort of rate of complexity. So thinking about trying to find a way to make it easier for people to move information between any kind of web application, because everyone's doing more and more of that, the single most basic requirements you can come up with are a way to copy things out of any web app and a way to paste things into any web app. That's it. And the easiest way to consider that is to think about your desktop clipboard that we've all been used to since the WIMP paradigm came around 25 or however many years ago it was. Copy, paste. It's really simple. We're used to it on the desktop. Why shouldn't web apps do this? There was a really effective post to this point by a guy named Bill Burcham on lesscode.org 3 or 4 months ago. So I would suggest you look for that. So UnAPI is starting with copy. It is one API. Starting with copy, because copy is the first part. There's no point pasting if you have nothing to copy. Copy is also something that's more broadly applicable than pasting. Everything that publishes information might give you a reason to copy something out of it. You might not want to be able to paste into every web app. So you got to have copy first. So UnAPI today is one API for the very most basic clipboard copy operations across sites. And what it really does is it co-publishes human and machine interfaces in ways that you can freely move between them. It's the universal symbol for freely moving between interfaces. So you're looking at a user interface optimized for humans, but embedded within that interface is information about connecting through the machine interfaces that are also available for the same information. And the goal with this is to do something that's so easy that most programmers can implement something that complies with the spec in under an hour. And to do that, it would be ideal if you could just layer it over other APIs that already have been implemented. So that's why we're taking the approach we're taking with an API. I was hoping this would elicit peals of laughter. If you can't tell, it looks like Ross is playing, I presume, the bass in pure Yngwie style. Anyway, I'll just keep going. So what is an API? It's a two-page spec. One would be better. It'd be nice if it were shorter. We're using this capricious and arbitrary set of rules for developing specs called Rogue 05, modeled after Dogma 95, if you're familiar with that film movement. The basic tenets of the Rogue 05 approach to developing specs is that development is public and it's on a public mailing list. You have to revise the specifications at 30, 60, and 90 days. There's a final version at 120 days. The point is just get something out there, start hammering on it, and get it done and keep it tight and short. And in all debates, working code will win. So that doesn't tell you anything about what it really is. It really is three things. It's a URI microformat for identifying objects on web page. If you want to copy something out of a page, now this is not saving a web page. We all know you can do that. The browsers have always been able to do that. But if you're looking at a hit list or a really interesting object of some type, you want to copy the object out of it. You have to be able to first identify in the markup on the page what the object is you want to grab. So first there's this URI microformat for identifying the objects themselves. There's an auto discovery mechanism for referring to the machine interface that co-publishes object information with the human interface. And there's a tiny little set of HTTP functions that are a basic convention for accessing the objects and information about them. So just to step through those very quickly, the URI microformat is not yet clear, but it's going to be something very simple. It'll be like a span tag with a class of URI with the URI itself between the tags, or it'll be an anchor tag with some extra information, the rel and type and title attributes. In some ways, it doesn't really matter. The question is, do we want to take a purely microformats.org sort of approach or not? Most of these will probably work. The link auto discovery convention is just like what you've seen for RSS auto discovery, except we're just going to point to an API URL. I don't see anyone shaking their heads, and I see a few people nodding, so I just assume everyone knows what that is, so I'll keep going. Does anyone not know what that means? Okay. Do you use Safari or Firefox? Okay, so when you go to a website, like a blog, there's a little orange satellite button that says you can subscribe to the information on that. That button pops up if there's an auto discovery link saying where the RSS feed is. So it's the same convention. So finally, the trickiest part is a set of HTTP defined functions for answering requests like, well, for this object, what formats is it available in? Okay, I want this format for that object, give it to me. And you know, just so I don't have to hit you twice every time I want to copy something out of here, just give me a list of all the formats you support on the site. It sounds a lot like OAI, but it also sounds sort of like OpenURL, and it sort of sounds like the Atom Publishing Protocol, doesn't it? So why not one of those? Well, OAI is a great spec, but people don't get it if they're not in the library space. And I hate to say that, because I would think it's incredibly simple, but it's not. Some of the smartest people I've interacted with online that are not in the library space have looked at it and come away scratching their heads. And that's just not good enough for something that we want to catch on this widely. The Atom Publishing Protocol looks like a great idea, but you can't really find it yet. It's not done as a spec. There aren't libraries supporting it. And the only major sites that allow you to publish using it are sites like Blogger, where everything's behind a password, so you can't do general queries and stuff. Why not the Entrama Zoogler Pack API? Well, they're all different. That's the key. Every one of those APIs, no matter how good it is different from every other one. So remember the complexity problem when you've got your, you know, n squared growth rate every time you add an interface? Actually, it's not n squared. It's I'm sorry. I've been taking math classes, so I should be able to do this, but it's like n squared minus 1 over n or something like that, right? The key is you have to keep the simplicity really, really down, up. Simplicity up, complexity down for the developers. So if you can come up with just one simple API, then you don't have to worry about everybody always implementing all these different ones. And well, why not OpenURL? It kind of sounds like some things we can do with OpenURL. Well, yeah, it is. But look at OAI. If you think people are going to get OAI and you're surprised that they don't even try showing them the OpenURL spec. And I say that with knowledge that people who worked on the spec in this room don't necessarily disagree with that. Again, it's a great spec. I use it. All our institutions use it. But it's not something people get right away. The trick is we want it to be easy to add over any of these. So what does it really look like? Well, the HTTP functions are really simple. There's a base URL. There's an introspection document at the base URL, most likely for a list of all the formats the site supports. And you can get a format list for a specific URI. And there's a format call for a URI and a format pair. I've got like 5 or 6 left. 10. Oh, even better. So that makes it look sort of like it's done, right? Well, it's really not. It's only been a spec for about 30 days. We have a revision of it due tomorrow, actually, which is why I kind of timed it so we could work on it later today. There are a lot of choices we need to make, at least provisionally, about what to make up ourselves, what conventions to use ourselves. There's this little known piece of HTTP called the 300 multiple choices response that has a similarly little known RFC 2295 that goes along with it, specifying how to implement that in a way that's somewhat more standard and allows things, something called transparent content negotiation. I kind of like that because it means we don't have to invent it. We can just reference it and say, implement this way. But it's something people don't know, and we're not quite clear how well libraries that support HTTP support it. Browsers know about it, web servers know about it, but they have this weird default behavior, default location headers. What is the introspection format, and what exactly is the micro format going to be? It's a lot of decisions to make. Fortunately, we could make them all kind of provisionally just to keep moving and to have a target people can try implementing. Like I said, the revision is due tomorrow. This is the 30-day revision. So I'd very much recommend you to come join us later in the afternoon for the breakout session. We're going to hopefully, we have a really large cross-section of the people who've been active discussing it so far, that are here in the room today. So I'm hoping that most of you and anyone else who's interested can sit around the table and we can just make some provisional choices about these things. We don't have to get it all right now. So we can compromise and pick some choices and make notes why we decided to go one way or the other, and we could just try it for the next 30 days and go back and make changes again. If you're really interested, I'd encourage you to Google something called the GCS PCS list. And if you don't track that now, come up and catch me and I'll point you to it more specifically. Try implementing the spec and help us take over the world. I don't know if you can read that. These are all pictures from Access Hackfest's past. And in the corner, Art is saying, see right here, this is where my brain pauses having switched from discussing quantum mechanics. This is actual quote. All of these are actual quotes except for the follow-on ones. And then Walter's response is, you mean right here? And Art says, yes. And meanwhile, Calvin is wondering what the heck the letters are doing hovering in space. I just got this software. My skills aren't that great. So have a little fun with UnAPI, with OPA. And OPA is what you say when you light the Saganaki on fire in a Greek restaurant. So I thought it was kind of a fun thing. It recursively stands for OPA proxies APIs. It's just a few hundred lines of Python, and it's a demonstration application. I do see some practical uses for it, but I'm not really trying to take over the world with it. What it does is it proxies well-known other APIs. There are two modes. One is command line, and I thought you can read this. So you can basically call a script and pass it a URI, and if the URI is one that matches a pattern it's configured to understand, it will give you a list of format names and their MIME types. So I'm passing it a Unilog. Unilog is a link logging tool I work on that has an OAI interface. So this is proxying Unilog's OAI interface. You pass it a URI from Unilog, and it will tell you, it can give you OAI DC and mods. And then you call the script again with the URI, and you say mods as a suffix, basically, and it will give you the mods record. It will proxy the OAI, pull out just the mods part, and give you just the mods part. No header, no OAI wrapper. I can actually show this live, but there's also a web view, because that's more interesting. And the web view implements an API, naturally. This is what the same thing we just did looks like on the web version. And I have a bunch of screenshots, but I'm going to try to cut over to the live version. If they don't work, I'll go live. But basically, the top level thing is an HTTP status 300 multiple choices. If you've never seen this in action, turn on mod spelling in your Apache server and create an arbitrary link somewhere on your site called 111.html and another one called 113.html, and then visit the URL 112.html. Apache will figure out that it doesn't exactly match a file that exists, but there are two files that are close in that they have one character different. But there are two files that are close, so it can't choose for you. So it will say multiple choices. These appear to match what you're talking about. That's an HTTP 300 response. And again, it tells you what the formats are using the RFC 2295 response pattern and the alternates header. And you can get the DC right out of it. So let me see if this will work. No. Yes. All right. So this is a live. Okay. Here's Flickr. Here's a, I put up as a librarian, I collect things, and I scanned a bunch of tickets from concerts I've been to, and this is a Flickr page with my photo here. Has anyone? But I won't do that. We don't have enough time. But this is the OPA response. If you look at the URL, it's flickr.com/photos/dchud809... I basically passed that into OPA as an unAPI call with just the URI, and it returns all these responses. Dublin Core, mods, HTML, square, thumbnail. Of course, Dublin Core and mods don't come out of Flickr itself. I just wrote a translation so that we could get mods. You know, it'd be fun to see mods for Flickr entry, and indeed it is quite fun. Just look how fun that is. Look, mods for Flickr, right? Yeah, Walter's jumping over there. Yeah, exactly. it'll take you right back to the page because the HTML representation is a decent representation as well. It's a little slow. Somebody's uploading someone's iTunes sharing. That's what's going on in here. And then you can get, you know, the different sizes here. Let's get the small version of it. So it will give you just the object back with the appropriate MIME type set in the header. So you can write code that will intercept this, read the response, and present a nicer list for the user, or in your Grease Monkey script, or in a pop-up dialog, or an extension, whatever you want to do. Very simple, straight HTTP. Here is PubMed, a record about a ministerial meeting on population, ... Here's the formats list for that. You can get the PubMed XML. You can also get an ASN1 representation, since we don't talk about ASN1 a lot. Here's ASN1 for that record. And if you can read the URL, this is really going through OPA. I won't ask you to say OPA every time. Here's a book. I wrote a generic handler for ISBN URIs, which is URN colon ISBN colon the ISBN value. There's a book by someone you've heard from recently. Here's the formats call through OPA. It uses Amazon in the background, and you can get a mods record again out of Amazon. Pretty exciting, huh? So that's the mods record. And you can get the Amazon data. And again, it goes and it pulls out just the item bit from Amazon. So you don't have to deal with the wrapper. Again, you want to standardize everything, so just get me the record itself. This is American Memory. I said it can proxy any OAI service. There's a two-line config file, which I can show you. Maybe that's silly, but this is it. You probably can't see that, but this is a configuration for an OAI service. You give it the OAI base URL, and you give it an identifier regular expression. And if you do that and restart OPA, it will take any identifiers that match that pattern, and it will try to proxy that way through the OAI service. And here's American Memory, and here's all its options, and here's OAI DC for that. So we have improvised protection for a steam bank, right? Improvised protection for a steam bank. This is going through Library of Congress's OAI service that goes along with American Memory. This was really fun. I went to the Illinois registry of OAI services and just took five of them at random, and four of them worked immediately because OAI is a great spec. And that's what you get. This is Unilog. I did this originally. This is Ed Summers 1.0's link log in Unilog. And every one of these things has an ID, and you can grab a record for them. Let's do mods here too. This is running locally, and that doesn't look very good. What'd you say, 30? Okay, so I'm done, I think. This you've seen, this you've seen, this you've seen. Here's some details about how it works. I'm happy to show you the code. The next steps are basically to improve, revise, and implement on API come tomorrow, or come later today if you want to help with that. If you saw the coins PMH stuff I did at Access last year, I basically want to replace all of that with this. And there are a lot more API providers we can add to OPA just to show off the paradigm. And that's it. Thanks. Do I have time for a question or no? So I have time for a question while Jeff sets up, if anyone has any.
What's the reaction then on the micro formatless band? Are they interested in this as well?
I haven't bothered them with that. I did ask a couple months ago about the cool machine, about the URI identifier micro format, because it seemed like a no-brainer, right? Yeah, just put a URI class on top of it, and they didn't see it. If I had more time, I would go into my spiel about what people don't get about identifiers. And one of the things is that not all identifiers are resolvable as such. And I think they just don't see that lesson. They think they live in a web-only world, and we don't. So I would like to get their approval. You know, you'd like to get something that they support, and maybe we can convince them of that. But in the meantime, there's no reason we can't just go ahead and adopt our own convention. And maybe that would help prove to them that it's a good idea. If somebody has a better approach to getting through to those people, because they're really hard-headed about what they do, which is why what they do is so good. I'd appreciate your advice. I better get out of the way. Thanks.
Internal and external. I did, but it worked.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about WikiD, which is a wiki for data, basically. And to give you a broad overview of it, it's an open source online database for servicing multiple collections of arbitrary data. So you can think of it as a wiki, except you're not just stuck with wiki data. You can use any kind of data that you have. It's a J2 EE web app, so you can drop it into a Tomcat server. It's customizable and extensible, so you can change the displays using XSL. You can create new crosswalks between data using XSL. You can create new services for your data using Java. And it's built using these protocols. And so you talk about mashups. This is sort of a mashup of these protocols. So I think it's useful to compare WikiD to the OAI protocol, because a lot of people are familiar with that, comfortable with it. So in the OAI world, you have identifiable distributed repositories. And in this case, I have a repository called gsafd.oclc.org. And I have the option of using that in my OAI identifiers so that people know, you know, where these things come from. On the WikiD side, you know, this is all running on a common server, so I have local collections, which are sort of similar to these distributed repositories. And in my case, I use CamelCase, because there's sort of some wikiness about this. And my collections are always going to start with the word collection. That's how I know that they're collections. Looking back at OAI, you have identifiable items. And here's an example of an item in my GSAFD repository, and I can get this item out of that repository in various formats. On the WikiD side, I also have items in my collection, and going back to my way of identifying things, this is, you know, my local identifier is GSAFD0001 within the collection of GSAFD. And in OAI, people tend to think in terms of metadata, but I like to think in terms of content, which metadata is one form of content, but I also you know, think of content in general. So I'm going to call them record formats. And I can get these items out in whatever format I want. On the OAI side, you've got the OAI registry at UIUC, which is a database of all the known OAI repositories out in the world. In that database, my GSAFP repository is identified by that OAI identifier. You can see my identifier stuck at the end of that. On the WikiD side, I have a similar collection called Collection Collection, and my GSAFD registration record exists in that collection using that identifier. Looking back at OAI again, you've got a fixed number of OAI verbs. On my side, I can have an extensible list of actions, and there's certain actions that are fixed that are, I know, can work across any kind of collection, just like OAI has some that it knows are going to work across any kind of collection. But you can also create your own or change them or whatever. On the OAI side, in the identify response, you can specify branding, an icon, a style sheet that you would like people to use with your data. Nobody in the right mind should do that, but on my side, I've got the same idea where I can assign a style sheet to any given collection. OAI is a read-only protocol. In my system, you can read and write data to these collections. And in OAI, you can only access the latest record only. In my system, you can go back and get previous versions of those records. So that's sort of how it stacks up against OAI, which this sort of evolved out of an OAI-based model. So I have three primary collections that I use to bootstrap the system. I've already mentioned one of them, Collection Collection. That's where I store my information about all the other collections. Well, this is a collection, so it gets included also. I also have a collection of schemas. So if I have a collection of MARC records, somehow, somewhere, I have to know about MARC, you know, what MARC is. So I put that information in this collection. So I give each schema a title, so I can put it in pull down lists. I have to know the namespace of that MARC schema, for example. I need to know where the schema is for that. So I put all that information into a convenient item, and I can just refer to that item anytime I need to. My third bootstrap collection is a collection of wiki markup pages, and that's going to serve as my user interface. And I've been using a shorthand to refer to these things. You know, you've seen these identifiers before, but internally they're all represented as URIs, and that's what I'm showing up at the top there. For purposes of wiki, though, I don't want to have to deal with URIs. I just want to refer to them by the shorthand. And these are persistent in the same sense that OAI identifiers are persistent, where if I have an item in the repository and I go change it, I would hope in the OAI world that they would maintain that identifier. They wouldn't go changing it every time the data changed. So we're looking at my sandbox page, and I just got done editing it. I had created a reference on there to something called Collection GSAFD. My wiki parser knows that it's a camel case word, starts with the word collection. That's something special. It goes, takes that word, looks it up in the collection. It didn't find it, so if it had found it, it would have hotlinked it. But since it doesn't find it, it puts up a question mark. And if I click on the question mark, it brings up a form that lets me create that collection. And I've gone ahead and filled out that form for us. GSAFD is a thesaurus. Here's a description of it where you can get more information. Some things I need to know about this collection before I can really do anything with it is, what kind of identifiers do I have? You know, do I want to assign the identifiers manually, or can I just assign a sequential number, have the system assign those numbers for me? A style sheet. The system will automatically use a default style sheet unless I say that I want to use a custom one. And if I want to use a custom one, then I have to do a little bit of work behind the scenes. But in this case, my data is special enough that I want to customize it. The native record schema. This data is already out there. I can download a file. It's in MARC format, so I'll just go ahead and load it into my system in that MARC format, store it that way. If nobody wants to look at MARC, there's a format called Zethus, which is geared toward thesaurus type information. So I'm going to crosswalk Mark into Zethus using an XSL style sheet and then make that my default. I've got a default button there saying whenever I go to display, assume it's being displayed in the Zethus format by default. And just to kind of support OAI downstream a little bit, I've got some metadata prefixes off there so that I can take these collections and provide them through the OAI protocol, but, you know, which likes dealing with these metadata prefixes. So I click on the submit button. And now I have to store this information somewhere. That form submittal gets stored, gets converted into an XML document and stored on the file server. But my system can handle any kind of data, and it's kind of hard to index an arbitrary XML document. I mean, how would you do that? You can't do that. So rather than indexing the XML directly, I create a metadata record for it. And these are the fields in my metadata record. I have a persistent item identifier, which in OAI terms would be, you know, the third part of the identifier. I've got my collection identifier, which would be the second part of the OAI identifier. I have a piece of the native record that I can use for display purposes in brief display or sorting or whatever. When the record was created in the database, when it was last updated, that way I can harvest the data. And all of these metadata records for all my collections, all the items, they all get stored into a single SRU database. So let's go back again. We just filled out the form. We hit the submit button. What happens in detail? I have a web service called WebEdit that takes those form data pairs and generates a simple XML document, just a linear list of key value as an XML document. And then on that form, there's a hidden field that references a style sheet, an XSL style sheet. I take that style sheet, run that document through it, and that produces the metadata record that I just described. But, you know, I also, as part of that, go ahead and generate the native record. If my record's in MARC format, this same style sheet also generates the native record, and then I base64 encode it and store it in the metadata record. So I have an HTML form submittal coming in, and on the other end coming out, I've got a metadata record with my native record base64 encoded in there. So that's somewhere I want to store that thing. How do I do that? And that's where SRU update comes in. SRU is a protocol developed by the SRU community to store XML data into an SRU database. And Ralph Levan wrote an implementation of this that understands, you know, that funny metadata record that I created. He yanks out the base64 encoded native record, unpacks it, and stores it on the file system somewhere. He takes the URL where he stored it, plugs it back in the metadata record, touches some of the dates, and then stores that in his SRU database. So I have an SRU database now with metadata records in it that point to the native record off in the file somewhere, my MARC record or my Dublin Core record. So here's what my metadata record looks like for that record we just got done submitting, my collection description record. You know, I've got my identifier for that item. This is a description of GSAFD within the collection. I've got a, you know, label for it so I can show it in the list. And I've got my link to that description record off in the file system somewhere. It's a relative link. So that's now in the database. And if I go back to my sandbox page, it sees now that that GSAFD collection has a description, so I can go ahead and hotlink it. And when I click on that hotlink, it brings me here. We have the collection created, but there's nothing in it yet. I have several ways that I can add items to this collection. One way is to create a reference to the item on a wiki page. You know, collection GSAFD colon some local identifier. If I put that on a wiki page, click on it, it'll let me create a record. Another way is to type in an identifier up in that top box and hit create item, and that'll also bring up a form that I can fill out. And then a third way is I can import records from some external source. And that's what I'm going to do here. So these records are available on somebody's websites as MARC XML. I type in the URL, hit the import button, it grabs the file, and one by one, it runs it through that process of creating the metadata record, Base64 encoding the MARC, and calling SRU update to store it in the database. And when you get done, you come up with, I guess I'm going to jump ahead here, you come up with a display of all the records that just got done importing. So let me back up and see what I missed. Great job. Yeah. So we can't index those MARC records, so you know we're creating the metadata. This is what one of the metadata records would look for one of those thesaurus entries. We've got an identifier for one of the terms. This is going into the collection GSAFD. I pluck out a piece from the native record, use that for sorting and display, brief displays, and then I've got a link to my MARC record. So far everything I've described is just, you know, sort of tricky little SRU type stuff, SRU updates. And SRUs are great for searching, but sometimes you want to do more complex things. And some examples would be, you know, I've got these URLs in the records that SRU gives me, but what I really want is the dereference metadata, the dereference records. So I need a service to pull those out, and SRU is not going to do that for me. Or I might want to perform several queries, combine the results, and give that to the user. Or I might want to crosswalk those MARC records into Zethus, for example. Or I might want to take those SRU queries, convert those into the OAI equivalent, and give that to the client, or RSS. And OpenURL gives us the protocol for doing any of those kind of services. And you just have to take my word for that, I guess. OpenURL is a difficult thing to wrap your mind around, but it's capable of doing all these things. And I think I showed you that. So OpenURL's just great. I love it. But the URLs that it creates are just hideous. I mean, no user in the mind would wanna type in that URL. And what that URL does, and I've highlighted the key pieces of it, you're asking the server to edit the front page of my wiki collection. That's what that first URL does. But to kind of simplify things, I have a separate servlet called WikiD that you type in an abbreviated form of that, and all it does is just takes those pieces of data, transforms it into that first OpenURL request, and then hands it off to the resolver to do the work. So human users would typically want to use that abbreviated form, but automated processes have all these other protocols built right there, you know, being used, that they can go out directly. They can access the OpenURL server directly. They can access SRU directly if they want. You know, if somebody doesn't like the way I do my edits and so forth, they can build their own editor and give me the records through SRU update and so forth. Here's a diagram of the system. You've got your database here at on the bottom. Records coming in from the browser through web edit into update, back out through SRW, SRU, into OpenURL, and then up through the WikiD servlet. And these are all open source components. They can all be used independently of one another. You know, if there are certain pieces of this that are useful, other pieces that aren't, you can just pick and choose which ones you want to use. So I think I'm done. There's some links. So one question?
Yeah.
Sure.
I'm confused about the indexing. Because you said you can't index the content. It looks like what you're indexing the metadata.
Right, which isn't very much.
If you want to use a, say I wanted to look up the subjects
right.
in the MARC record.
Right.
Do you need to add a layer?
Right.
I mean, I would assume you somehow add a layer that would return an ID and then you can use the rest of the system to pull the record out.
I mean, as a general principle, I can't know anything at all about the content, as a general rule, because I can handle anything. But on a collection-by-collection basis, I know exactly what's in that collection. I know this collection has MARC records. And so I can go in, and in the metadata for those records, I can include any pieces. As I'm constructing those metadata records, I can add the pieces that I want to index, and then behind the scenes, have those indexes look for those pieces and include them.
So on a collection-by-collection
exactly.
basis, you would change the
right.
add fields to the metadata.
Right, as a configuration behind-the-scenes type of thing. It'd be great if I could index arbitrary things as part of the user interface, but it's just too hard. And maybe someday Ralph will figure out how I can do that. Roy.
Jeff, the chat room thinks you should pronounce it Wicked.
Oh, yeah, I don't know, it's pretentious. I mean, the whole thing's pretentious. Sure. Oh, sure, yeah, absolutely. Oh, that's enough. If you have questions, I'm happy to answer them offline.
So now we're breaking for lunch, which will be out for the park design tour, and then we will resume at 1 p.m.